of Saudi Arabia is to reinstate the former Yemeni president.
They want to return Mr. Hadi back to power. You can't return somebody back to power with killing those people you want him to come and rule. You are killing them and you want him back to come and do what? What is he coming back to do? To come and rule who? Innocent people or dead bodies?
The protester said human feeling should prevail over the intrigues of the power struggle on the situation in Yemen. They added that the senseless shelling of innocent civilians in Yemen must stop, while the international community has a moral responsibility to put a stop to the carnage. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
A new report, an assessment of the British government's widely criticized multi-million dollar a year counter-extremism strategy known as PREVENT, first introduced after the 2005 London bombings.
The People's Review of PREVENT essentially puts forward the voices of those who have been impacted by PREVENT, as opposed to the government review, which is speaking primarily to people who are in receipt of PREVENT funding and essentially have a vested interest in having more PREVENT.
Millions of those funds are being injected into areas with 73% Muslim populations, codenamed PPAs, Prevent Priority Areas. The British government dismisses all criticism of its strategy and claims Prevent is a vital part of their counterterrorism work, which safeguards vulnerable people from being drawn into terrorism since 2012. The authors of the 65-page People's Review of Prevent think otherwise.
It hasn't been vital, and I think many people, not just community groups, not just human rights groups, but even members of parliament and UN special rapporteurs have put together criticisms and concerns about the fact that this could potentially be causing radicalization rather than stopping it.
Bearing the brunt of it all, Britain's Muslim community, children interrogated by PREVENT officers, at times without their parents knowing.
Over 50% of the referrals within PREVENT are of young people and children. That includes children as young as 4 and children at primary school. There's no possibility that they're at risk of being drawn into terrorist activities.
The review cites multiple examples of the devastation caused by PREVENT. The so-called Trojan horse affair is one. False reports in 2014 of an Islamist plot to take over schools in Birmingham, ending up ruining the lives and careers of dozens of school teachers.
The problem with the school was that it was a Muslim-led school, that it was a Muslim-majority school, and what was being built up, if that school had continued its successes, would be a group of Muslim-led schools within a Muslim-led academy trust. That was what was being broken up.
Despite its failures, though, there are now fears that the government here might be marketing PREVENT to other countries, some with questionable human rights records. The authors of People's Review of PREVENT and other critics say this strategy is racist, fuels and legitimizes Islamophobia, and therefore must be scrapped once and for all. Saeed Pourreza, London.
A dream has become a reality. The Conference of the Birds, composed by the brilliant young musician Mehsan Marvasti and inspired by a poem of the same name written by poet Attar of Nishapur in the 12th century, performed here in London. It's a story all Iranians are familiar with, about an epic journey to find the Simurgh.
The Simurgh is to the east what the phoenix is to the west, a mythical creature that symbolizes transformation. And the story of the Simurgh is a spiritual one, full of courage, determination, and self-discovery.
Well, I think it's the first time I've seen so prominently advertised a non-Western musical traditional concert. And I've got a long-standing interest in music from the different parts of the Islamic world. It kind of evokes sort of deeper feelings, spiritual feelings. And the fact that this specific concert is about kind of a spiritual poem, it taps into something which I think a lot of us are looking for, especially in this post-pandemic, current pandemic situation. We're looking for some deeper meanings, So I think it will be striking a chord for a lot of people.
It's a mix of fusion of different music, and that's always interesting. And it's Eurasian music, and it uses different instruments from across Asia to represent birds, and it just sounded lovely.
Even though there are differences, cultural differences between these places and these peoples, and those differences should be recognised in general, that through things like music and art, there can also be synergy and, like, yeah, things can work together as well.
5 years in the making, the Conference of the Birds, conducted by Farnoush Behzad, brought together musicians and instruments from across the world. It fuses Azeri, Chinese, Indian, Arabic, Afghan, Armenian and Persian music, brought to the audience by a Western orchestra. The performance was accompanied by two elocutionists who narrated the story and animated clips of birds and their migratory lives. The art and culture of Iran needs no introduction, renowned worldwide. But young Iranian artists living far from home are always looking for ways to capture the spirit of their homeland and offer Western audiences a taste of Iran. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fueled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined, and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified. Seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan Horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
The United Nations aid chief Martin Griffiths said the humanitarian operations in Yemen is about to start doing a lot less. In his latest briefing to the UN Security Council, he warned that the aid agencies are quickly running out of money, forcing them to slash life-saving programs. His remarks has sparked harsh reactions in Yemen.
The UN's decision to cut humanitarian aid threatens the lives of millions of Yemenis. The United Nations is subject to the conditions of donors, most of whom are from the countries of the Saudi-led coalition, and therefore they are politicizing humanitarian aid to achieve what they have failed militarily. The United Nations describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and Yemenis have been suffering since the beginning of the war, and the UN aid is already scarce.
Since January, the World Food Programme has reduced rations for 8 million of the 13 million Yemenis it feeds each month. Griffiths said rations may be cut further from March or even stopped, meaning that millions of Yemenis may die of hunger.
When we see the reality and what is happening on the ground and how the Yemeni army continues to achieve victories in various battlefronts, we realize that the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its declared goals, and therefore they are seeking to put pressure on the Yemeni army by reducing humanitarian aid to the country. Reports confirm the high rate of death among children, and this confirms the failure of the United Nations humanitarian operation in Yemen.
The reduction in food rations comes with millions of people in Yemen facing starvation as a result of the ongoing years-long Saudi war and the blockade imposed on their country.
As observers say, the United Nations may announce a death sentence for millions of Yemenis if gaps in its funding are not filled. They warn that if the world body wants to save more lives in Yemen, it must reduce the operational expenses of its agencies that deplete the humanitarian funding. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Despite a statement by Lebanon's Interior Minister Bassam Maulawi last week directing security forces to cancel any event critical of the Bahraini regime, prominent Bahraini opposition group Al-Wifaq held its scheduled event. The event, titled United for Justice, marked 11 years since Bahrain witnessed popular uprising demanding justice and political freedom.
As Bahraini opposition and Bahraini factions, we are working on unifying our stances. What unites us is more than what divides us. We're united in our cause, and our demands for justice and freedom are one.
Those who support the Bahraini opposition believe that the Bahraini people struggle for freedom, and any people's uprising for the sake of reform is similar to the Palestinian people's struggle for liberation from the Israeli occupation.
The struggle to face the forging of people's will and theft of their rights and resources, and the hijacking of political decision, as well as fighting for human rights in Bahrain, are similar to facing the Zionist enemy in Palestine and facing corruption and wrong in Lebanon, and facing the conspiracy in Syria. This is one confrontation and one battle. The Bahraini normalization of ties and the visit of the Israeli Prime Minister prove what we have been calling for in the last 10 years.
The political representatives and Muslim clerics attending the event stress that as Lebanon has always been a place for freedom of speech, opposition members of any country, as well as the Bahraini opposition groups, should be allowed to come here and speak. In addition to a violent crackdown on peaceful protesters, the Bahraini regime has now taken the lead in its normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, thereby going against its people's main cause. Experts believe this issue could further energize the Bahraini opposition in its struggle to be heard. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalized several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over and radicalize schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed, and we witnessed this firsthand, was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized. I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
In the limelight.
Americans are in a sour mood with their elected officials, blame the pandemic or inflation or Trumpism or stress or structural problems like inequality. But people do not feel that the system, much less its leaders, are working for them. The nation is experiencing a crisis of confidence that is eating away at its strength and unity. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, Members of Congress Should Not Be Trading Stocks, Ever. And it has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. Americans are in a sour mood with their elected officials, blame the pandemic or inflation or Trumpism or stress or structural problems like inequality. But the American public do not feel that the system, much less its leaders, are working for them. The nation is experiencing a crisis of confidence that is eating away at its strength and unity. Addressing this problem calls for long-term vision and commitment, things politicians aren't always known for. But a straightforward idea gaining traction on Capitol Hill could reassure a frustrated and exhausted American public that lawmakers at least recognize this trust deficit. A ban on stock trading by members of Congress and their spouses. This idea got a fresh jolt in the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, after some lawmakers first faced awkward questions about whether they used non-public information to make lucrative stock trades, just as the severity of the threat posed by the coronavirus was becoming clear. A report in December by Insider was more definitive. It revealed that in 2020 and 2021, dozens of lawmakers failed to abide by rules requiring them to promptly disclose stock trades above a certain threshold. The investigation also found that Congress does a poor job of enforcing accountability and transparency measures. In response to the uproar, there has been a push by both political parties in both houses of Congress to establish stronger guardrails on congressional stock ownership. Multiple lawmakers have introduced bills pushing variations of a ban on trading individual stocks, some tougher and more expansive than others. The House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy reportedly told donors in January that if, as expected, Republicans win back the House in the midterm elections this fall, they would work to pass legislation that would limit lawmakers' ability to trade stocks. In a high-stakes election year, with lawmakers eager to show voters that they feel their rage, now is the moment to drive home this popular common-sense reform. The American public has lost faith in Congress. Restoring trust in this institution requires concrete bipartisan change. It has been a decade since Congress last made a significant effort at policing itself in this area. The Stalk Act of 2012, among other measures, made it illegal for lawmakers to trade based on access to non-public information. The reforms were well-intentioned but inadequate. In practice, there are too many legal shades of grey. A clearer, brighter line needs to be drawn. For all of the Democratic Party's talk about restoring public faith in government, its leaders in the House of Representatives have been, until recently, resistant to talk of a trading ban for members. "We are a free market economy," House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said in December. She added, "They should be able to participate in that." The Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, has been similarly weak, suggesting that a ban is unnecessary. While Mr. Hoyer owns no stock, he has said that members ought not to be in a different situation that they would otherwise be if they weren't members of Congress. This rationale does not pass the sniff test. Members of Congress have access to a steady stream of information that regular Americans do not. They already exist in a different, more privileged situation. The common argument that a trading ban would pose a hardship for lawmakers is no more compelling. Most of the proposals under consideration do not call for members of Congress to sell all their stock holdings. They would merely prohibit lawmakers from trading stocks in individual companies. Assets could still be held in vehicles such as index funds or blind trusts. It also bears noting that only a sliver of American families, about 15%, directly hold stock in individual companies, as opposed to indirectly through mutual funds and the like. A stock trading ban would put lawmakers more in sync with the 85% of the American public who own no individual stock, rather than align them with the interests of the 15% of the American public who do. A ban on congressional trading enjoys a bipartisan appeal that is rare in this polarized age. A January opinion poll found that 63% of the American voters are at least somewhat in favor of such a move, with strong backing among Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike. With the support for reform growing, Nancy Pelosi adjusted course this month, saying she was open to a ban and announcing that the House Administration Committee would look into the situation. The committee chairwoman, Zoe Lofgren of California, has said her team is analyzing the existing bills and would put together a broad-based consensus proposal. The speaker's public shift was vital to keeping the push alive, but there is a difference between grudging acceptance and vigorous support. Proponents of reform need to keep the pressure on to ensure that this effort does not get slow-walked or bogged down in the devilish details. Nancy Pelosi, for instance, insisted that reform legislation should apply not only to Congress but also to the judiciary, including the Supreme Court. "It has to be government-wide," she said. The judicial branch certainly could use some ethical shoring up. An investigation last year by the Wall Street Journal found that from 2010 to 2018, 131 federal judges unlawfully ruled in cases involving companies in which they or their family members held shares. People involved in close to 800 lawsuits have since been notified that their cases are eligible to be reopened because of these conflicts. There are proposals floating around that would address all three branches of the government. Two Democrats, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York and Representative Katie Porter of California, recently reintroduced a bill that would tighten reporting requirements across the board, as well as bar trading of individual stocks by members of Congress, the President and Vice President, Supreme Court justices, and other top officials with the US Federal Reserve, which suffered its own trading scandals last year. But trying to extend a government-wide ban while worthy under merits would introduce needless and potentially counterproductive complexity right now. There are, most specifically, concerns that an attempt by Congress to impose its will on the judiciary would set off a debilitating debate over the separation of powers. That is literally a different conversation, and one that is so hard to wrap your arms around that you've tanked the movement, as Representative Abigail Spanberger, a Virginia Democrat who co-wrote one of the leading reform bills, lamented to the New York Times. Lawmakers' top priority, arguably their first duty, should be to clean up their own branch of government. They are, as elected officials, directly accountable to their voters, and many of the people to whom they owe their jobs and salaries have grave doubts about their ethical guidelines and rules of fair play. In a series of recent New York Times opinion focus groups, voters across the political spectrum described their frustrations and even anger at the political class and the system, seeing elected officials in both political parties as acting in self-interest without rules or consequences. They all just go to their barbecues and cocktail parties and laugh, said one independent voter. They just want the power. They couldn't care less about us. Some Democratic voters expressed interest in term limits, curbs on lobbyist influence on lawmakers, and new rules and money in politics. The push for a trading ban is about more than imposing rules to keep lawmakers on the straight and narrow. It is about changing the widespread perception of public service as a playground for corruption and for self-dealing. It is about restoring the American public's faith in their government. For Congress, there may be no worthier cause.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Now that the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna have reached a critical stage, Iran's parliament has sprung into action. Iranian lawmakers have urged the government not to back down from its red lines and national interests during the Vienna talks. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will review what those red lines are for Iran and whether the European, and in particular the U.S. side, is finally ready to make the political decision to respect Iran's red lines, like the lifting of all sanctions, and to then in turn revive the JCPOA. First, let's get an idea about where these talks are in Vienna, the JCPOA removal talks. Homa Leslie is our correspondent who joins us from Vienna. Homa, at this point, I hate to say a critical stage because every time there are talks, they're critical. But again, we're looking at some major developments, I'm guessing. Bring us up to speed as to what they are.
Yes. Well, today there was another meeting between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Ali Bagheri-Kani, and his team, and EU coordinator Enrico Mora. And there was also another meeting between the Iranian and Chinese teams. And after his meeting with the Iranian lead delegate, the Chinese ambassador said that we are continuing to narrow down our differences and that there are some very good efforts underway to resolve, of course, the outstanding remaining issues. There was also yesterday another meeting between the Iranians and the Russians, and the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Oryanov, described that meeting as very interesting, professional, and including in-depth discussion, he said, on the remaining issues. And he said that in my view, in the view of the Russians at least, there will be an agreement or a deal by the end of February. That's not a long way away now, of course. And he said that we are now, the Vienna talks are now in the home stretch. So looking at what, of course, the demands have been, what the remaining issues are, I think when you look at the set of issues that have been outlined by Iranian MPs, you can see and guess from them what those important outstanding issues or remaining issues actually are, both when it comes to the scope of sanctions and also when it comes to the verification of the sanctions removal and guarantees that there won't be further sanctions or that the US or other parties will not withdraw from the agreement. And as we've discussed this before, there has been this idea circulating that's been described as an inherent guarantee within the text of the deal based on which the other parties would have to officially include this in the draft, that if any of the participants commits a violation or reimposes sanctions or withdraws, etc., Iran will reserve the right to do this, this, and this when it comes to its nuclear measures, clearly what's been described as inherent guarantees. But there's also, of course, the issue, we've said, of what sanctions need to be removed. And the MPs, they're referring specifically to the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, the Direct Sanctions Act that's related to Iran, etc., etc. Some of those sanctions mentioned there, the U-turn regulations when it comes to banking relations, and also the issue of snapback, because there is a clause in the JCPOA saying that if there is non-performance by any of the participants, then there will be a snapback of the UN Security Council resolutions against Iran that were, of course, based on the JCPOA, removed and terminated. So again, these are all, I just like to conclude by saying, these are all what we heard from the MPs, demands that we've also been hearing quite clearly from this delegation here in Vienna. And they have been saying from the beginning that what they mean by a sustainable and durable deal is one that includes all these issues.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that. We have a noted official here in the studio tonight. Hopefully we'll get clarification and remove any questions, marks on that. Homa Leslie, of course, one of there from Vienna. Many thanks. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have inside the studio with us a noted official. At this point, it would be Abu Fawaz Amoui, member of the National Security and Foreign Policy Commission of the Iranian Parliament and a former diplomat. Also joining us in this Spotlight, we have Mohammad Morandi. He's the advisor to the Iran negotiating team who joins us from Vienna.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both, and I'd like to start out with you, if I may. Parliament has spoken.
Yes.
And basically what it has said, paraphrasing it, we must learn from the past and set the Iranian nation's interest as a red lines and do not commit ourselves to any agreement unless necessary guarantees have been received. So the two key phrases here that I'm going to ask you in form of a question, what those red lines are and what those guarantees are that the Iranian parliament is looking after for it to be enacted.
Yes, as you mentioned, now we have seen that it is a critical time for the negotiation in Vienna. And because of that, the member of the parliament, I mean that the majority of the parliament today have a statement that mentioned two major issues. First of all, we give our support, full support to the negotiation team, because we know that they are doing their best to get Iranian interest. And the another issue was mentioned over there was some sort of the red lines that are very important for the Iranian parliament. One of them was related to the guarantees. You know, we have very bad experience in past time. I mean that when the United States was member of the JCPOA, they have withdrawn illegally from the JCPOA, and they have made their best effort to destroy the JCPOA. I mean that any agreement by participation of the participation of the United States can have the same experiment. I mean that if United States again be a member of the JCPOA, there is no guarantee that they do not do the same that what they have done in the past. Because of that, we are mentioning over there the, some sort of the guarantee. One of them was that. First of all, we are asking the United States that do not again withdraw from the disagreement. The second one is that we know that there is some sort of the mechanism inside the JCPOA, exactly the snapback mechanism. It's some sort of the mechanism that they can use it against Iranian. In past, I mean that 2 years ago, they have done the same act and try to destroy the JCPOA toward the United Nations Security Council, but they was not successful. It means that we need some sort of the guarantee to getting from the United States and to show the all parties they were the party that tried to destroy this agreement. That's right. And now they should, if they want to be again a member, we should have this sort of the guarantee to do not see the same bad measures that they have done in past.
Indeed. Mohamed Morandi, we're looking at Parliament speaking, and that in itself obviously is of great importance coming in at this stage. So I'd like to find out from you what your impression of that is at this point for them to come out. And, of course, they have said their views on guarantees and of the red lines. Tell us what, in your opinion, it is that they are looking for when they say guarantees and red lines, things I'm sure that they have discussed, which, again, your input on this, of how that is going to be enacted in the final signing of the JCPOA revival agreement.
The nuclear negotiators from Iran are negotiating based upon the law that was passed by Parliament, and therefore they are pushing the negotiations forward in a way so that the law is not violated, and that if and when there's an agreement, when they bring it to Tehran, it will be able to be acceptable to the parliamentarians. So I don't think that that is a controversial issue whatsoever. The law that was passed, I think, is quite clear to everyone, and there are no ambiguities. The negotiations are very tough, and obviously Western countries are very antagonistic. Iran is using all the leverage that it has, and its negotiators are also being very tough at the table. But the framework in which they're pushing is the framework that is enshrined in Iranian law. For the negotiators, there are a number of issues that are key. One is, of course, the removal of sanctions and the breaking of the sanctions regime. Another is guarantees, because we learned this from our experience with Trump, that the United States suddenly pulled out of the JCPOA, and nothing happened. So this time around, the Iranians want to make sure that history does not repeat itself. Then there's the issue of verification. Unfortunately, in 2015, the Iranian side was subject to a verification process that was, of course, led by the International Atomic Energy Agency. But the other side did not have that sort of verification process. This is something that, this is something that has been addressed this time around. So these issues all have to be dealt with. And here I'm speaking as an individual, what I'm saying is not on behalf
Understood.
Of the delegation. If, let's say, Iran does not receive the sort of assurances that it requires or that it deems necessary, if it does not receive the guarantees that it deems necessary from Washington, in other words, assurances that stem from beyond Iran's borders, then they must have another means to have those assurances. In other words, to move those assurances inside the country, to bring those assurances inside the country. So there must be something that makes the United States or the Europeans feel that they have to pay a heavy cost in order to violate the deal. So if the assurances cannot be given by the United States in Washington, then those assurances have to be adequately met inside Iran's borders or created inside Iran's borders so that the other side feels that this impedes them from violating the deal.
Thank you for that. Abu Fass Amoui, I'm looking at sanctions, and that's obviously another big point made by Parliament, and they want to make sure that there's no ambiguity there. There seems to be some differences on the scope of the sanctions that need to be lifted. From the point of view of Iran's Parliament, what sanctions are they looking for that need to be lifted?
Just first of all, I should mention that we need some sort of the agreement, that it should be stable. I mean, because of that, we are stressing on the guarantees and other issues. Another one, it should be effective. I mean that when we are reaching to the agreement from Iranian side, the major goal is getting the economic benefit from the agreement. Because of that, we think that all the sanctions that are the problem and obstacles for Iranian to get the economic benefit from the agreement should be lifted. Because of that, we do not mention to the name. Just some of them are related to the nuclear activity. Some of them was related, I don't know, so-called the regional activity or different issues. Some of them are accused about the bad activity through the human right. But when it's come to the scene, major issue is that getting the economic benefit from the agreement. Because of that, we do not, just stopping about the name of the sanction. We think that all the sanctions, which was under the maximum pressure campaign in Trump era and before that, I mean that after the agreement between Iran and the 5+1 in 2015, after that, all of these sanctions are the problem and obstacles through the Iranian economic benefits. Mm-hmm. Because of that, in Parliament, we do not just watching that which one is related to the nuclear activity or another issues. We are here, and in our statement is stressed that all of these sanctions, without the name of that, without the tags that they have, it should be lifted. And it is the major instruction from Iranian Parliament, and as you have mentioned, the law that passed by Iranian Parliament last year, so-called strategic law on lifting the sanction. In that law, we had mentioned that this sort of the sanction, without the differences in the name, should be lifted. Now, in this statement, we have a stress on that, that all of these sanctions should be lifted.
So, Professor Mohamed Marandi, are we looking at this being in conformity based on the law that was passed by Parliament in terms of the requirements that they have, as relayed, I'm sure, by the negotiating team there in Vienna?
As I said earlier, the law that was passed by Parliament from the very beginning of the negotiations was respected by the negotiators. In other words, the negotiators were mindful that they had to respect the law and that they could not violate the law. And so during these many weeks that the delegation has been in Vienna, the Iranian side has been negotiating with that in mind. One thing that I would like to add is that a key issue that the Iranians have been pursuing is the fact that the different laws that were passed by the United States, the different sanctions that were passed by the United States under different names, all of them that were part of the maximum pressure campaign have to be removed, whether they are linked to the nuclear program, whether they are linked to Iran's regional alliances, whether they're linked to Iran's missile defense capabilities, or alleged human rights violations, which, of course, is the ultimate irony coming from Western countries that have been destroying country after country in our region. But all of them have to be removed for two reasons. One is that American officials have admitted, especially during the Trump regime, that all of these are part of a maximum pressure campaign to force Iran to accept changes to the nuclear deal. So in reality, even though they say it's about Iran's missile defense program or anything else, it's linked to the JCPOA and the nuclear program. And B, all of these sanctions are in violation of the nuclear deal because in the nuclear deal, the United States and its Western allies are not only supposed to end the sanctions regime and allow Iranian trade and business to normalize, but they're actually supposed to facilitate it. And these sanctions prevent that from happening. So the Iranians have been insistent that all of these sanctions, all of those sanctions within the framework of the maximum pressure regime that have been targeting Iranian women and children, they have to be removed. And they have to be verified. And this is very complicated. In other words, for example, if Iran wants to do business
right.
with another country, if Iran wants to export oil, then Iran has to see through verification that
right.
ships can leave port with insurance, that money can be moved from one bank to another, that the oil can reach another port and that port will accept the ship. All of these have to be verified before
okay.
the process moves on.
Well, I'd like to ask you that, if you can expand on that more for us, because that's one of the things that Parliament wants to make sure that is indeed going to happen, I'm sure, and that is the verification that's going to happen on this, the way it's going to get executed in terms of the lifting of the sanctions. Again, question marks lie in this area, if you can expand on that for us.
You know, just as I mentioned, that if we want an agreement that it is effective, we should concentrate on the issue of the verification. Just as my friend Dr. Marandi mentioned, in Iranian part of the commitments, you can see that there is some mechanism for verification. That we have seen that IAEA is the party that can verify that Iran is doing its obligation or not. But when it's come to through the sanction lifting, that it is commitment for the Western partners of the JCPOA, there is no verification mechanism. This is some issue that is newly is introduced through the negotiation. And it is very important for Iranian parliament because in past time that we have seen the implementation of the JCPOA, I mean from 2015 to 2018, we had seen that some sort of the sanction have been lifted just through the paper. When it's come to the reality, there is no sanction lifting. just we can see that there is okay for doing business through this company or that one. But when it's come to the reality, they say, no, this is there is another problem, another issue, and we should solve that. This time, we think that if we want an effective agreement, there should be some sort of the verification mechanism. If it comes through the selling the oil, there should be some time for that it is okay to sell Iranian oil to the different countries or not. If it comes through the sending Iranian ships, it's okay to have in different ports.
Sorry, because we're just out of time, I'm going to ask you one more question. This verification process is something that's going to be overlooked by Majlis in order for these different, and not just that aspect of it, but the Vienna conclusion will be overlooked by Majlis to see its execution in place?
Yes, as I mentioned, that through the Iranian parliament law that we passed last year, every agreement, I mean that Article 7 of this law, every agreement should come to the parliament, and we review that. If it is okay through our benefits and our goal through this law, we will pass that. But if we have some sort of the problem, we will resend it to the executive branch of the government and asking them to solve this problem. Okay. This is the process that we should follow up in after, I mean, that after the negotiation, this sort of the process should be done.
Very well. And last question to you, Dr. Morandi. We've had a number of our officials speak recently, quite a bit coming from the Supreme National Security Council, Dr. Shamkhani. Iran's leader actually spoke days ago. We've had, obviously, Iranian foreign ministers speak. If you can give us your impression of the way that they, the statements that they have made, and as to the way you sum up how they see the progress that's being made or lack of it.
Well, we have a very bad experience from 2015. The Americans violated the deal from day one under Obama, and they left the deal under Trump without any justification. And that's why the negotiating process has become so long during this period, because the Iranians want to make sure that history does not repeat itself. The Supreme National Security Council, Parliament, the President, the leader, everyone wants to make sure that the United States cannot fool around with the agreement in future. So the law passed by Parliament, I think, actually has helped the negotiators because forced the other side to recognize
that
there is no excess, that the Iranians will not be giving any concessions.
Indeed. Thank you. I'm sorry to jump in. We just don't have the time, but it was a pleasure, Mohammad Morandi. Advisor to Iran negotiating team from Vienna. Abu Faz Amoui, thank you so much. Member of National Security and Foreign Policy Commission of Iranian Parliament and a former diplomat. Nice to see you again. And at the top of that, we had Homolezki.